Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Aging is not for the faint of heart. And our guest is Dr. Charles Garfield, a psychologist, professor, and lecturer, and author of 13 books. And he joins us today to talk about his most recent book, Our Wisdom Years, Growing Older with Joy, Fulfillment, Resilience, and No Regrets. Some of the most profound growth of our lives can happen in the home stretch, the years after age 60 or so. It's a time when we can finally crystallize the meaning of what we've been and done and fully expand into the self we've always intended to be. But, says Dr. Garfield, that can only happen if we first loosen the grip of life we've led so far. The one that's been focused outwardly on activity, achievement, and the idea of success, and let our souls lead the way. Welcome, Dr. Garfield.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here with us. And let's jump right in real quick, because I'm still young and I want to get to the answers and achieve a lot. So what do you mean loosen the grip of life?
Well, no, what I'm saying there is that during adulthood, during that long phase from age perhaps 20 to 60, we're taught to climb the ladder, be a success, achieve a lot, get ahead, make a lot of money, do all these outward-directed things. When we hit 60, one of the things that happens that we almost never talk about is that there's a shift, a new stage of development starts, just as powerful as the one that went from adolescence to adulthood, but we don't know anything about it. There are very few user-friendly books, for instance, on dealing with the challenges of later life. So I decided to write one. And I called it Our Wisdom Years because wisdom, rather than achievement, turns out to be the primary objective of later life.
And I was just having a conversation with a friend who lost his wife last month, and we were talking about wisdom and knowledge, and really for us, the two of us kind of concluded we have a lot less of it, and that's where we're at, even though, you know, one would say we've accumulated more, but perhaps wisdom is not knowing. But, you know, we talk about this paradigm of wisdom, and what does that mean? Help us to understand what do you mean by wisdom?
Well, when we talk about wisdom, we talk about living a life based on our higher values, based on values like justice, and service, and compassion, and love, and gratitude, and beauty. When those things matter most, the way achievement and performance and success used to matter during our adult years, then we know that we've acquired the kind of wisdom that the great thinkers through the ages have talked about as central. There's a reason that the greatest humans who ever lived talk about love, for instance, as the central human value. It's because they're the wisest among us, and they're talking about the greatest wisdom that they have. So we're talking about higher values, again, rather than climbing a ladder and being a success.
Dr. Garfield, it's so interesting to me that so many of us say, oh, when I retire, I'm going to. And we may have these plans that we think we're setting in motion, but it seems so simple, you know, Pete's question, what is wisdom? But it's obvious that it's so difficult to switch gears, as evidenced by those people who retire. And then all those plans just, I don't know, they end up being lost because they so are so conditioned into that arc of productivity that they don't really know how to switch gears.
You said it really beautifully. That's right on target. We don't know how to end the priorities of adulthood, so we just continue them. It's all we know. We don't know that there's a new stage that we've entered that has a different set of priorities. And if you enter later life with the same priorities that you had during adulthood, well, you'll think in terms of retirement. Mm-hmm. And how much golf can you really play? And how many trips can you really take? And you find people, especially men, really struggling with later life because they don't have the social network that women tend to have. And it turns out to be a very difficult time if you don't realize that there are all sorts of other possibilities available to us in later life that have to do with, as I keep saying, higher values. What sort of service can you offer and to whom? How can compassion be an important value to you and, again, to whom? People talk in later life about two priorities more than anything else. They talk about love, people they love and who love them, their closest friendships, their closest family relationships. And they talk about work that they're proud of, work that they did that made a contribution, that offered something to the world or to an individual, that made things a little bit better. Love and work turn out to be the priorities of our wisdom years.
Mm. That's really nice. You know, you talk about at about age 60, we can start thinking of this, and many of us are still into, you know, the real high time of our careers and our productivity when we're 60. So if we're thinking about transitioning, how should we start thinking about it? I mean, is it the time that in addition to our work, we think of, oh, you know, it would be really great to go work at the food pantry? I bring that up because Pete actually works at a food pantry, but it's part of his real work, not his retirement.
It's both my achievement and my
compassion. So I'm wondering how you start thinking about that differently as you're making a transition.
It's a wonderful question. What I would suggest, and I say this in the book has lots of exercises, one of which really hits on what you just said. I would suggest that people visualize a time in their past. Think of a time in your past when what you did was most fulfilling and meaningful, but that you let go of, that's incomplete, that you never really finished. And ask yourself, if you committed to that, if you took on that activity that you let go of years ago and decided to fulfill it and actualize it, what would your life be 5 years from now? How would things be? I'll give you an example. My parents met in an acting class. My father was the lead man, and he wanted to be an actor more than anything else in the world. But it was the Great Depression, and times were tough, and acting was not a good choice if you wanted to make a living. So he went into sales, and for 40-some-odd years, he was a salesman. As soon as he retired, within weeks, he joined an acting troupe, ended up as the lead man again, and loved his acting opportunities, the ones that he had, and he was quite good at it. And I asked him, did you think about acting at all during those 40-some-odd years as a salesman? He said, I thought about it every day. I couldn't wait to get back to it. What time in your past, what activity in your past might trigger an activity for your future that would be most fulfilling during your wisdom years?
So I'm also a former teacher by trade, and it makes me think of, you know, a lot of times we don't train our youth and our kids or educate them for these later paradigm shifts. And whether it's, you know, having children, necessarily balancing a budget, dealing with the realities of life, but and then also retirement or just, you know, wisdom years. And how would you propose to, whether it's kids or, you know, 40-somes, to start to begin to process this before they get to 60, to make that paradigm shift?
What I would suggest is forget about the word retirement. Let go of that word. It has all sorts of baggage attached to it. It's like being sent to the glue factory. It's all over, and all you can do is play golf and go on vacations and watch movies. See this next phase as just as important to your welfare and fulfillment as adulthood was earlier in life. And make sure that you understand what the priorities of our wisdom years are. Those higher values, who truly loves us, where our friendships lie, what work are we most proud of that we might still do in some form. Forget about retirement. You're simply leaving one stage and entering another. The fastest growing segment of our population are people over 100. So if you're 60, you could live another 40 years. Again, that's a lot of golf and a lot of movies and a lot of vacations. You can't You can't fill your time with just those things. You have to have something just as formidable, just as nourishing emotionally and spiritually as achievement was during your adult years.
And that runs such in the face of our cultural norm to leave a legacy, to leave an imprint of your accomplishments and what you've and how you've impacted society. How would you tell those who are teaching leadership the difference between wisdom and legacy?
Well, legacy actually is a concrete expression of the wisdom you've acquired. What do you want to leave behind that's most important to you, that contains the most wisdom? As people get older, and you find people thinking about this even in midlife, even as soon as they have kids, if they do, or if they're teachers and they see their kids in their classroom, or they see other people around them who they care about, they start asking the question, what can I offer from the sum and substance of my life that might be useful to them? And I really suggest that people develop what I think of as a legacy project. It can be as simple as writing a letter to your grandchildren about your life and what values were most important to you. I think this whole notion of a legacy is extremely important, and you're quite right. We're not taught anything about this. There's all sorts of books on child development and adolescent development and certainly adult development, but what about later life development? There's precious few books available to teach us how to do this. That's why I wrote Our Wisdom Years.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Charles Garfield, and his book is Our Wisdom Years, Growing Older with Joy, Fulfillment, Resilience, and No Regrets. Dr. Garfield, also fascinating that you're the founder of the Shanti Project. And I looked it up, and it's so interesting that now more than ever during this time of the coronavirus, we are talking about isolation and feelings of isolation. And you started the Shanti Project exactly to address that issue. But in 1974, wow, you were really you had some foresight, let's say. And I'd love to just ask you a little bit about it, because it really does tie into your book. But it started in San Francisco, where you have lived, I assume, for many, many years, many decades. Can you tell us a little bit about why you started it?
Well, I was on the faculty at the Cancer Research Institute at the University of California Medical Center, and I saw all sorts of cancer patients who were seriously ill and who were alone and dealing with their struggles without the kind of emotional and spiritual support that you might think anybody would need in such a situation. They had doctors and nurses who were taking care of them, and their families visited every once in a while, but for the most part, they spent all sorts of endless hours alone. And I thought that if I could start a volunteer program, I would train volunteers and select them, and I would match them with our patients, and they would have somebody who could visit with them, a kind of friendly visitor who could spend some time with them. Well, that turned out to be a very useful addition to our care team. And when the AIDS epidemic hit seven years later, we were there, and we were the first organization around to take care of people with this new disease, HIV/AIDS, back in 1981. Well, now look where we are. We have COVID-19, we have the coronavirus, and Shanti, one more time, 46 years later, has stepped up and started a new program to care for people with this new illness. And we're providing support. We're doing shopping for people. We're doing counseling and friendly visiting online using all sorts of new technologies like Zoom and Skype and all sorts of things just to keep people part of the human community. 46 years later, and there are over 600 projects we know of around the world modeled after the original Shanti Project that I founded in 1974. That's my legacy project. To get back to the book, that's my legacy project, Shanti Project.
Oh, it certainly is. What a legacy. It's incredible. And I wish 2.5 months ago, well, coming up on 3 months ago, I would have learned about your Shanti project then, because so many of the conversations we've been having in our community is around how do we combat that feeling of isolation. And as we know, I mean, in our community, the need for mental health services has increased by about 40% in the last several months. But I wonder if we had, you know, formed our own small sort of Shanti project, and we have tried to in some, you know, sort of organically growing ways where we say, well, you know, call your neighbor and reach out to someone who's elderly and teach people how to get on Zoom. And it's a wonderful thing. But to know that you had this framework in place since 1974 is just incredible.
Well, I'm very proud of it. I'm very proud of the work we've done. And it's amazing. We never have trouble with volunteers. You'd think, can you really get people to do this work? It's difficult work. 6 times a year we do trainings, and 6 times a year I walk in and begin the trainings, and there they are, 25 or 30 new people who want to be Shanti volunteers.
It's because it helps all of us so much, even if we're the volunteers helping it, you know, helping others is helping ourselves, really.
That's exactly right. The way I say it is, the need to care is as powerful a need as the need for care. We need to give that care to other people. Compassion is a basic human value, and it's one of the things that surfaces during our wisdom years.
But I think it's important to note helping people, your definition of helping people and compassion is unique. And you know, in watching a little bit of the videos and learning a little bit more about the Shanti Project, can you really kind of give an example of what that might look like for our listeners?
An example of what the helping relationship might look like?
Yes, sir.
Well, actually, it's when I say it, it's not complicated. It sounds very simple. It boils down to 3 things. Learn to listen from the heart. Really listen to the other person and what they're saying. When an older person starts telling you their stories, and they will, they'll tell you all their stories of their life, take it as a sacred kind of thing, that they're giving you a gift. And then speak from the heart, tell them the truth as you know it from the experience of your own life, and then act from the heart. Those little things that you do for people that make all the difference in the world, you don't have to do anything major. You don't have to do anything that has monumental consequences. Just listen from the heart, speak from the heart, act from the heart. I talk about that a lot in the book.
It did seem like there was a slight difference, though, because, you know, I'll preface this with I'm an ENTJ personality by default, working to get out of that through much life experience and therapy. And and one of the things is that I am so focused on what it means to help people, what it means to kind of solve their problems. And the task that I've been faced with in my own life, and even sitting down with a friend just yesterday, is really to refrain judgment, refrain from thoughts and solutions, and just listen and be okay with the I don't know. And a lot of the testimonies you were shared on your website seem to resonate that same kind of just being with that existential Dasein.
You don't have to be a problem solver.
Right.
If you can be, terrific. But that's not the main thing. Do you have a comfort with not knowing when the problem can't be solved? But rather you simply listen to the person deeply. Can you just bear witness and show up? You know, the three characteristics that we talk about in the book are showing up, paying attention, and caring. That's all you have to do. You have to get really good at it, and you can through practice. You can, especially when somebody's important to you.
So the way you organize your book makes it so accessible. You have 3 parts, turning to the voice, tuning in to the Voice of Wisdom, there we go, seeing your life through wisdom's eyes and heart, and then opening to the eternal. And within those three parts, you have nine different tasks. Can you just kind of quickly give us an overview? It makes it so you could actually tackle one task, you know, per week and sort of say, this is the task I'm focusing on this week or this month.
That's exactly right. You know, let me focus on one right now, gratitude. One of the things you see with older people is that they respond really well when you ask them the question, what are you most grateful for in your life? And you know what the way they frame gratitude is really fascinating to me. It's different than what adults frequently do. They talk about forgiveness and how grateful they are that they were able to forgive themselves for something they did in their past that they regret. And I suggest in the book an exercise where people write a forgiveness letter to themselves that includes the observation that they did the best they could given who they were at the time and what they knew at the time. And write in the letter what you've learned from this situation that you'll never do again. And it's one of the things that we talk about in one of the chapters. We talk about gratitude a lot. We also talk about gratitude fatigue, which is an interesting concept I've never seen anywhere else. You were advised in many books and other places, self-help books especially, to write long to-do lists of the things that you're most grateful for. And then it becomes a chore. It becomes an obligation. What I suggest is a couple of times a week, write down three things that really light you up, that you're really most grateful for. And make sure, if it has to do with another person, that you let them know, that you communicate to them, that you don't let time go by where you never say to the other person how grateful you are that they're in your life or that they provide some service for you that you value a great deal. Make sure that the gratitude that you express is real for you, emotionally real, rather than another obligation, another to-do list.
And thank you. And we're so honored to have you and have you share your wisdom in the book. And I look forward to sharing this book with friends and others. The book is Our Wisdom Years, Growing Older with Joy, Fulfillment, Resilience, and No Regrets. And to end on just one last question, the big chunk of your book is to really look at our own lives and to spend time evaluating, thinking, reflecting, reviewing, and using our life to catapult us into the future. Why is that so important for us?
Well, Socrates, the great philosopher, said it perfectly. The unexamined life is not worth living. We have to provide ourselves the opportunity to really examine our lives, especially when we enter our wisdom years. We look back at the long arc of our life and we ask, what did I learn, particularly about love and work that I value? The unexamined life is not worth living. Socrates was right all those centuries ago.
Dr. Charles Garfield, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. And I just want to say, Father's Day is just around the corner. I know what my father's getting for Father's Day. Just saying. Thanks for joining us. Great to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.